RG58 at the 100 watt level and less, I think is no problem. 200 watts and above, I think you're pushing your luck. 200 watts on a 50 ohm line is 100 volts at 2 amperes. So if you include the RF loss and the current of 2 amperes flowing through that rather tiny center conductor, it's going to get hot. When you use a poor man's choke, RF choke, by multiple turns of the transmission line, the usual place people place that is at the antenna itself. You want to choke any signal coming from the antenna that might be trying to launch a signal down the outside of the coax cable, and you want to stop it right at the source, the antenna itself. Let me drop it. And in that way, your whole length of transmission line is not radiating. To put the RF choke at the shack end of the coax cable, where there the transmitter is shielded, the coax cable, if it's properly installed with its connector, to the feed-through connector of the transmitter, that's shielded. There is no radiation taking place from the shack end. If radiation is taking place, it's coming from the antenna end. Therefore, you want to put the RF choke up there. The failure that you experienced, was it in the RF choke? You may have said it, but I missed that, Andy. Where was the failure, and how do you know you've got a failure? You saw the cable overheat. You saw it bubble. So where was the failure, and how do you know you had a failure? N2HUH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The choke, the RF choke was at the antenna end. It was right after the tuner. And the plastic coffee can, the plastic coffee container was melted in the very beginning end towards the transmitter. So basically, the reason why I said it that way was you have, it could have melted from the antenna tuner end or the transmitter end. It melted on the beginning of the coil after the transmitter, although the actual coil was right smack next to the automatic antenna tuner, the you would call that the remote tuner, or external tuner. So it was right after it. And so on the transmitter side of the coil, the heating took place.
Do you have reason to believe that every band that you operated on, the antenna tuner came to a good solution with low standing wave ratio, or were there some bands where the antenna tuner, the automatic antenna tuner, went through a search procedure and didn't come up with a good result? On top of that, what is your indication that the antenna tuner had automatically done its tuning and arrived at an answer? One possibility is you've got the equivalent of a Berg watt meter or a standing wave ratio meter in the shack, and when the antenna tuner has done its thing, the apparent Biswar goes to a very low number. So did you ever see a high standing wave ratio on your transmission line? And do you have any reason to believe that in any of the bands you operated at, the antenna tuner had trouble finding a solution? N2HUH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, the antenna tuner has a green light to tune, and a red light tells you it was unsuccessful. I wouldn't operate on an unsuccessful tune. There is always a chance that I'm with a manual tuner, or otherwise I may have been a little aggressive, but not actually operate. But I would say most likely not. And I don't do anything other than single sideband. I'm not sure what caused the melting, whether it was trying to load up a ballon with the amplifier and the manual or tuner. That could have possibly caused the initial bound. There was no need to use the choke, but the choke was part of the my system, and I was experimenting with different type of feeds, whether it would be Ballon or the antenna tune or otherwise the other Ballon that I mentioned. So I was just wondering if I can narrow down what may have caused this heating. And I guess that's what you're trying to do for me, N2HOH.
Yeah, part of what's going on here, Andy, is that this is something occurring in your shack with your equipment. You have a mental picture of all of your equipment. You've given us a few words. There's a huge amount of missing information in our brain where you've got this beautiful mental picture, but I've been inside your head. Your antenna tuner is an automatic type. It gives you a green light or a red light. Does that mean you look outside the shack and you look up in the air at the antenna tuner to see if the red light or the green light is lit? Or is there a way that it gives you that information in the shack? Is there a way in the shack where you can force manual tuning? That's my first set of questions. Where's the red light? Can you do manual tuning? But my next question is, what was the antenna? You haven't told us what kind of antenna you were using. N2HUH, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, it's not a automatic. It's a forced manual tune control head in the shack, and separate wire to the external remote tuning unit, which is in the end room inside the house, with a random and fed wire going to the AH2 automatic antenna tuner. That's Alpha Henry 2 automatic antenna tuner, and it only accepts a long wire, random wire type of antenna feed. There's no other, SO239 or input into that external antenna unit. And that wire is approximately 50 feet long. And I was, as I said, I experimented with that. And if I wasn't using the ICOM AH2 with that piece of coaxial cable, I was then using a manual tuner and a Ballon. But most of my operating is with the ICOM AH2 antenna tuner and the 50-foot and fed wire to the tuner.
Okay, now we're getting much more of the picture, Andy. So it's an end-fed random length wire, roughly 50 feet long, but not necessarily resonant on any of the bands you're operating on. Your whole transmission line coax cable going up to the antenna tuner, and the antenna tuner itself would love to have two separate wires coming out of it, center conductor and shield, so to speak. But your antenna doesn't have two connection points, only one. So therefore, the rest of the system is floating. And therefore, the length of your random wire, your 50-foot radiator, and the transmission line plus antenna tuner feeding it, could, in theory, all become hot. RF-wise, it's not a balanced antenna. It's a very balanced, unbalanced antenna that you're using. Let me drop it. On top of that, if there was ever a time when the standing wave ratio was higher than 1:1 on the shack side of the coax, then my calculation of 200 watts being 100 volts RMS at 2 amperes RMS goes out the window real fast. Depending on how high the standing wave ratio is, you can have a much higher current and much higher voltage on various places between shield and center conductor of the coax. And because you've got an unbalanced antenna, your coax itself probably was also radiating on the outside, so other currents are flowing on the shield itself. In my opinion, Andy, you're pushing your luck to put 200 watts into RG58. I think you should be using a healthier kind of coax cable. And the RG58 you're using, let me drop it. Somebody thought you said RG58 mini. but maybe you didn't say that, but somebody thought you did. And I wonder what the manufacturer, I wonder if you know what the manufacturer recommends as the maximum amount of watts for that particular cable at the highest frequency where you use it. That means something you should be checking on. So the heat that you experienced, I see a number of mechanisms by which it could have happened. And your next question is going to be, what do I do to correct it? I'd use a heavier coax. I would consider changing the length of the transmission line, of the radiator. Just some small amount. Just to make sure that if you did get some kind of a crazy resonance, length of line plus cable, making it a resonant system starting at the shack end, if you know what I mean. That's the problem of an unbalanced transmission line. It has a high probability of giving current on the outside. And the choke that you're using tries to help that. I think you told us how many turns the choke was. Something like 4-inch diameter, plastic coffee can, and some number of turns. Wonder how many turns you used. Over to you, Andy, KTRIW.
I would say somewhere between 12 and 16 turns. And to my other part of my station, I used RG8 or 9913. What this was a convenience step where I could use an ICOM H2 automatic antenna tuner, and the wire is coming to an end room window, and I can run the coax on a floor to the shack, and it's inside. Most of everything is inside the house. Everything's inside the house, you know, weather protected, except the actual piece of random wire. So the random wire is outside the window, but everything else is inside the shack. And I like that to experiment with safely, comfortably, easily. It's an experimental portion of the shack. Everything else is, large coax, 213, 9913, and RG88. So, it was just for convenience, and I probably would never use it again. I guess the smallest will be RG8X from now on for the experimental, for that experimental line, N2H2H.
This 50-foot random length wire outside the shack, outside the house, what bands did you use that on, Andy?
Okay, 50 feet is approximate. I did use a non-resonant length between 50 and 63 feet. I've changed it a couple of times, but basically I can contact in QSO, actual QSO on 160 up to 6 meters. The only band I don't think I can tune with that H2 was 12 meters. And I was going to experiment more with that, but that's the only band I couldn't tune at all. And I believe that was the only one that doesn't tune at all. Yes, everything else can tune almost one-to-one, so or an acceptable range for the tuner, which I believe is very close to that. So it was very successful, and I've been using it for almost a year now. But I did something in the experimental stage went awry and unfortunately damaged that coax.
Yeah, Andy, you just gave us a very critical piece of information. 160 meters on a 50-foot length of random wire. Wow. If you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, these curves of what impedance does the antenna wire really have versus its diameter and length. And in your case, 50 feet, a half wavelength on 160 meters is around 260 feet. That random length of wire would like to be 260 feet or half of that long. And you've got 50 feet. If I looked at the Brown and Woodward curve, I'm pretty sure I'd find out that antenna, N-fed, right at the piece of wire itself, probably has 10,000 ohms of capacitive reactance. And you're trying to feed that with an antenna tuner. Wow. That is a, almost 100-to-1 standing wave ratio. My guess is when you're on 160 meters, if you QSY 20 kilohertz, I'll bet you you've got to retune that antenna tuner. And that antenna tuner is working real hard. I'm amazed that it has enough range to do that. So you've got an extreme high capacitor reactance impedance, extreme high standing wave ratio, fed with a small diameter coax cable with a lot of power, 200 watts. You've pushed the state of the art beyond the usual limits on that one, Andy. I wonder if you see where I'm going on that one. N2HUH, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, positively, Dick. You've got it. Yes, I like pushing the envelope. And that's exactly what I did. And I'm very happy because I enjoy having QSOs on 160 when I get home, when I'm midnight or go on 80 meters at 2 o'clock in the morning and DX. I mean, I love it. I mean, basically, I have a complete station, one radio, 200 watts, antenna tuner, and a piece of wire, and I'm in business. And, I do other things. I have other rigs and amplifiers. But the point is I did push it. And I'm so happy with the performance that I'm willing to go out and spend $1,000 on an automatic antenna tuner or $1,500 or whatever it takes. And I'm having a ball. But, I just don't want to have problems. So I guess the main thing is 200 watts or less is RG8X, and a kilowatt I'll use, or anything above 200 watts will be the big stuff, of course, the thick stuff. So, I learned my lesson, but the experimentation was fun, and you made your point, and I'm glad you did, and I enjoyed it, but I learned my lesson. Thank you much, Dick. N2HUH.
I'm glad you brought this to our attention, Andy. You did an interesting set of experiments. What you've damaged is a piece of coax cable. You haven't burned up a whole lot of dollars or a whole lot of expensive equipment. Because I think you've got something like a 100-to-1 standing wave ratio on that antenna, that implies that when I calculated 100 volts at 2 amperes for 200 watts on a 50-ohm line, and you combine that with these extremely high standing wave ratios, that 2 amperes of current could probably become 40 amps, and the 100 volts can probably become 10,000 volts, depending on what phase angle is this extremely high standing wave ratio. So you've proven that you can heat a piece of coax in a very elaborate manner. And in the case of 160 meters, were you getting some good signal reports, Andy? Were you happy with the way the 160 meters worked with that particular antenna? N2HUH, KQRIW.
Yes, you hit the nail right on the head, Dick. You hit the nail right on the head. I was in QSO at stations that, even out of state on 160, that, the same station was telling another station in New York, I can't hear you, you gotta do XYZ antenna or whatever. And I'm using a barefoot radio, and I'm QSOing, and I'm loving it because, I'm 10 dB over, or I'm only S7, or it's noisy tonight, and you gotta do better, but, I'm getting a contact. Maybe not a QSO, some nights is a QSO, and the other stations that are doing the same thing I'm doing, even with better antennas, are getting, try again next time, and I'm in QSO, so it was running excellent. I mean, I'm happy it wasn't that, even the wire was not very high, it's not more than apex 30 to 35 feet. I mean, nothing special here, and it was working, and I was happy.
Well done. And by the way, you did see melting of the plastic coffee can. Did the antenna stop working, or the melting is what alarmed you, but it was still working up until that time? So, did the antenna stop working at some time, Andy? Go ahead.
Well, it didn't actually stop when I started investigating. I actually changed the connectors. What I did do was waste time. I changed the connectors first because I thought I noticed an intermittent or a bad SWR that I was experiencing a bad SWR or a high SWR. And then actually, I a couple of times I thought I noticed a short. And I'm that critical where I can just notice an SWR difference. I mean, I take notes sometimes, and even just in my head, and I just notice these things. I'm very critical about my operating. And changed the coax connectors on one end and both ends. And then when I had, then I got to the point where I was troubleshooting. Hold, stand by, let me let it drop. Where I had the coffee can in my hand with the coax and the continuity tester latched and unlatched and the ohmmeter and everything else, whatever I was doing, and just holding it and moving the can, that I noticed it, a short. I said, now what's going on here? It's not the connectors, it's the coax cable. And lo and behold, when I did closer examination, took everything apart. The plastic container is melt, has a melt point where the, and that's exactly where I went and cut the coax. And when I took it apart and stripped it, I saw the permutation of the center conductor through the dielectric.
Yeah, that's a pretty strong clue. Okay. One last question. Had you put that antenna back in service? And if so, what did you do to do that? Or is it something you were about to do, Andy? Go ahead.
For now, I took out the RF choke. There's no more RF choke, but the RF choke plus whatever's left of the cable after I cut out the bad part is still part of that now, the active antenna system. I'm still using it, although it's unnoticed that I'm getting another piece of coax, RG8X, and it'll take its place as soon as I get that that piece of coax, and then that piece that I have will be thrown out permanently in the garbage. So I'm just waiting for the RG8X to come in. So thank you for asking, and thanks for your help, N2HOH.
One last comment. Because your antenna is an unbalanced antenna, NFED, doesn't have two leads to it, so to speak, it has a strong probability of putting current on the outside of the coax feeding it. And with your RF choke that you had, the possibility exists that an extremely large voltage was also being developed across that RF choke. For all we know, some of the heating it experienced was actually arcing of high voltage. So eliminating the RF choke is a good experiment. Anything you can do to slightly increase the diameter of the cable, I think would help. I think RG58 or RG8X, if that's what it is, RG58-like cable with 200 watts is getting close to the point where it's going to give you some grief. And do try to find the manufacturer's rating for that cable at your highest frequency. Good luck with that experiment, Andy. And after you make the change and get it back in operation, please come back and tell us how well it's performing. I'm going to go over to Joe next, KC2QYW. Joe?
Maximum power is 370 watts at 50 megahertz.
Okay, 370 watts. Okay, so you weren't exceeding the rating. That's if it was in a 50-ohm, one-to-one system. And at first you'd say, by way of his remote antenna tuner, you hope that's what was happening. But with an NFED antenna, which has a strong tendency to feed current on the outside of the transmission line, other things were going on, is my best guess. Thank you for that information, Eric. KC2QIW, how are those electrons in Harrison, New York, treating you tonight, Joe? You got it, Joe.
Roger, Roger. Thank you very much. Love you guys, and Happy New Year. Harrison is treating me very, very good, you know. So, when I get a chance, I'm going to put up a friggin' tower in the backyard over here. So, okay, let me get to the point. Let me get to my question over here. Okay, Dick, my question to you is, K can Yaesu headquarters over there out, I believe it's out in California, can they refuse you for a for the warranty? So my question to you is I'm gonna send my radio over there like next week, because it's a Yaesu FTDX 3000D. What happened was, like, when I heat up the stock microphone, the fast channel mode comes on the display, and I think what happened was when I bought a power microphone that I hooked up to it, that started happening when I heat up the mic. So now I don't use that power microphone anymore. But my question to you, Dick, is if they cannot fix it, will they send me a new radio? Back to you, Dick.
I think one of the big variables is how long ago did you buy your Yaesu rig? And before you added the power mic, was everything pretty happy? And what was your motivation for using a power mic as opposed to the one that was supplied with it, Joe? KC2QIW, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah, to answer your questions, it's still in warranty. It's not over a year yet. And the second question is, I don't know, I just want to try new things out. You know, you look on the website, they advertise it, built-in power microphone, has a built-in EQ, it has all this bells and whistles on it, and I'm thinking, cool, you know, I'll order the power microphone and test it out, and now I know, just stick with the stuff that comes with it. And believe it or not, it wasn't that much of a difference, you know, when I put the headphones on to listen to the talkback, you know, when I switched back and forth with the microphones and whatnot, it was no real difference. So I hope the Yaesu people can fix it, you know, because now what happened, okay, to answer your other question, yeah, everything was working good. Everything was working good on the radio, but then when I hooked up that power microphone to the radio, that's when funny stuff started happening. Like, you know, like when I key up on the mic, the the word fast will pop up on the display. So I think I messed it up by hooking up that power mic. Back to you.
Now let me hear this one more time now. With the regular mic, everything was beautiful. You went to the power mic and you got this failure. If you disconnect the power mic and go back to the original microphone, is it still in a failure mode? Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, roger, roger. Yeah, when I hook up the stock microphone, yeah, so now I'm getting that problem now. Like, the fast mode, channel fast mode will pop up on the display. No matter what microphone I'll use now. Yeah, so that's to answer your question. That's what's happening right now. So hopefully they can fix it. And I guess my second question to you guys is, let's say if they cannot fix it for some reason, what do they do? Do they send you a new radio under their warranty?
Dick, N2EO, what about him trying to reboot the microprocessor?
Yeah, have you done a reboot of the microprocessor, Joe? Go ahead.
Roger, roger. Yeah, I did all that, guys. I did everything. Yeah, you guys are too smart. You guys are too smart for me. But yeah, I did everything. I did the full reset. What's that called? Wait, full reset settings on the radio itself. You know how you do the full factory resets, and just like the other station said, I did that. I reset that, and I'm still getting the same problem. So most likely, something happened with something, you know, so.
Okay, Jimmy J, go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, if you're working with FM radio, and there's no reason for you to even think about How am I? Thing AM or CB, if you want to think that. Yaesu actually sends data through the mic connector, depending on which mic you have. And there's usually a menu setting. Like you said, you did a full reset. We're supposed to reset everything back to default. So there's a possibility that you damage the input to the data line on the microphone connector because something else is connected to it, unless, of course, the manufacturer said they manufactured that microphone for that specific radio, which I doubt. Or you might have actually put voltage down a line that's expecting to receive data, or something of that nature. Yaesu will fix it. And if it means replacing the microprocessor board, they'll replace it. In warranty, you'll get it back.
Yeah, what you're saying is a good sign, Eric. Joe, when you mail that back to Yaesu and you tell them about the complaint, I would just happen to forget to tell them that you used a power microphone. You're currently using the supplied microphone and you've got this failure mode. And let them just go with that, and I think they're going to fix it for you. It's a little bit dishonest, but to happen not to mention is my suggestion that you use the power mic. That may have aggravated it. The possibility exists that the power microphone is really a red herring, that the failure occurred, the microprocessor failure occurred just because it had a latent defect. Somebody had given it an ESD surge before you got it. So under warranty, I think you're going to get a repair when you send it back. Back to you for any required fills there, Joe. KC2QIW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, roger, roger. Of course, I know that. I know not to say that I hooked up one of the aftermarket power microphones, of course. You know, I know not to say that, you know. So I'm going to mail it out next week. And, you know, with all the paperwork that goes with it, all the information they need, you know, the warranty, the receipts and everything, and, I guess I'll get back to you guys on that. So, I guess in the future, you know, I'm just going to, whatever comes with the radios from now on, I'll just use what comes with it, you know, so I don't run into that problem ever again, you know. So, I mean, the radio still works, everything still works, and, I did everything you guys could think about. I did everything. I did the factory settings. I even bought another stock microphone, you know, that comes with the radio, and I hooked it up, and it's still doing the same thing. So, other people will say, oh, try a different microphone. Try this, try that. And I tried every little thing that you could think of. So, thank you guys. Thank you for the good advice, and I'll definitely let you know when I get the radio back. But I'm not going to mail it out until next week. I'll mail it out next week. So, back to the net.
And to we owe Dick.
Yeah, Eric, I've got a question for Eric, and then I'm going to go over to Rich in that order. Eric, to my knowledge, a so-called power microphone has some electronic circuitry that does speech processing. It's going to give you a kind of clipping action. But still, what comes out of the power microphone is purely audio. How can higher processed speech audio coming out of a microphone damage...
Repeater, timeout.
How can that damage the microprocessor in that rig? KE2EJ for an explanation on that. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Let me ask you this question. Have you seen a microphone connector on a recent radio lately? How many pins does it have?
Okay, it's got 40,000 pins, and I think you're saying that this power microphone is not made to be compatible with that particular rig. Therefore, it might be drawing funny amounts of current or doing funny contacts on some of those zillion connectors. Is that possibly what's the aggravating factor here? Back to you, Eric.
All right, let me give you a little clue. Your Tektronix oscilloscope has a little ring around the PNC connector. But when you put a particular probe in it, it shows you whether it's times 10 times 100 or times 1 gives you the actual voltage gradual on the scope, you don't, and you know that's done with a programming resistor, right?
Okay, so there's a whole lot of other functions going on with that multi-pin connector on the front panel, and a non-compatible power mic, I think you're saying, was aggravating some of those functions. I think that's what you're saying, Eric. Go ahead.
Let me go a step further. Many of today's rigs will actually allow you to buy a microphone that will put a display on the microphone so you see what channel you're on, stuff like that. Most of the newer stuff that has the funky beyond the touchtone buttons on it has a little microprocessor in the microphone. And there's, you know, the traditional audio line, the traditional PCP line, and some other stuff. Sometimes it's the up and down button, sometimes it's the stereo line. Depends on the radio, what the design is. But yeah, you can feed a nasty voltage down into a line receiver and maybe it'll poof, and it only sees half the bits it's supposed to see, and it gives you a funky response every time. That sort of thing can happen. The fact that it will talk serially back to the radio, where it might actually be saying this may in fact be a problem, I'm this particular type of radio, it forces the radio's microprocessor to change the setting in the menu to that particular version of microphone, which has different meaning for the data that's coming back and forth. So that could have in fact happened. And when he hits the reset button to reset the microprocessor, there are certain things that it doesn't actually reset, and it might, that might be one of them, but you never know. K2RIW, K2J.
Very glad you gave us all that extra information, Eric. A lot more clear now. Rich, N2EO, what would you like to say to Joe? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Tech. Excuse me. I'm wondering, I love this possibility. But many years ago, was a digital radio mailed to me from Florida by a gal I knew and her husband. And she asked me to sell it for her, as he had passed on. And, you know, that's because I ran my little servicing business, so we thought I could sell it for her and send her the money. Anyway, when the radio arrived, it came UPS. All the digital stuff was not working. It was so bad, I tried to repair it and had to give up. I'm wondering if we both wondered if the radio had been x-rayed coming up from Florida. There's a lot of drug dealers, so I don't know. But if that's the case that you think, what do you think that Joe ought to do? I think he ought to wrap the radio in tin foil first, then put it in a box, kind of thing.
I'm having trouble believing that the tin foil would give you very much protection from x-rays. Let's see what Eric's got to say on this one now, Eric. And by the way, is Yaesu in Florida? I thought Yaesu was in California. So, KE2EJ? Got any suggestions with reference to x-ray protection during shipment? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if you're really that loony that you think you need to protect yourself from the x-rays of the baggage x-ray machine, which is a little stronger than the stuff that they use when they when you go through the line itself. You know, you can put cameras with CCDs and all sorts of really wonderful, delicate stuff that's not necessarily radiation hardened in any form, and it's not an issue. But if you wanted to stop the x-rays, for sure, go get yourself a film bag. It's made out of lead. That works.
Okay, just asking. I don't know what happened to this radio, and Dick, you misunderstand. The radio was mailed to me by this gal who owned it in Florida. Yes, it was in California.
Understand. If I was using an old-fashioned 35mm film camera and I put that through baggage check, would that film get exposed, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW.
If you were processing the film at 800 ASA or higher, 1500 ASA, yeah, you'd get a little bit of fog. It would be very slight fog. You'd actually have to take an exact sensitometer to see it. But, it will, in effect, affect a silver halide part of we're talking at a molecular level in terms of that. In terms of transistors, tell you a funny story about the way he's really building satellites. We go through all this craziness for radiation hardened components. They just buy the stuff from what used to be Schweber, which is now Arrow. They test the stuff out, they pick the parts that they like out of the bunch, and off it goes into space. What does that say to you?
Understand, that's a pretty severe environment. I think you've got some wind running over your microphone. I'm hearing a little bit of a rushing noise. Not to worry, you sound good. So, good luck with that procedure, Joe, and let us know how that turns out. I think Yesu is going to fix it for you. The next person who was on our list was Steve, KD2HUC. And Steve had mailed me an email in which he asked a very good question. So, let me double check that the email that you mailed me, I'm about to describe that incident. Is that the one you were about to ask tonight, Joe? Just in case, Steve, just in case you have a different question. KD2HUC for confirmation. K2RIW in the tech man.
Yes, Dick, that's the question based on the email.
Very good, Steve. I've got to double check this because sometimes I go, way off to one side describing something to somebody to which you'll say, hey, that's not the subject. What Steve wants to know is that when a dipole-like structure, like the driven element of a Yagi, or maybe a dipole all by itself, is fed with a gamma rod, the gamma feeding procedure starts off with the center conductor of the driven element of the dipole grounded, quite possibly grounded to the boom of a Yagi, and then there's the center conductor of the transmission line goes to a rod. The rod runs parallel to one side of the dipole, maybe one third or so of the length of that dipole, and then it has a clip that goes over to the dipole itself. And in that rod is a series capacitor. It's two telescoping pieces of tubing. Let me drop. If you put a dipole in free space and you feed it in the center and you measure the impedance, it's very close to 72 or 73 ohms resistive impedance if the dipole is the right length. When you put that dipole inside of a Yagi antenna, the loading effect of the reflector and all the directors on a good Yagi design, typically that dipole now becomes a 20 ohm impedance instead of a 73 ohm impedance, maybe 23 ohms, so it's something in that order. You've got to do something to raise the impedance of the dipole. If you fed the dipole with a T-match system, in other words, a rod going to the left and to the right, and you're not feeding the dipole in the center, you're feeding the dipole further out, closer to the end, you will see higher and higher impedance as you go out there. Well, you don't have to do it in a balanced manner like a T-match. A gamma match, which is only half of a T-match, the rod goes out parallel to the dipole on one side with this telescoping series capacitor, and then a clip goes to the dipole itself. That will raise the impedance for you. You can make that 20-ohm dipole act like 50 ohms when you feed it in that manner. Let me drop. The rod that brings you out further onto the dipole where the impedance is higher, it has inductance. In order to cancel the inductance of that rod, they add a series capacitor. So the two telescoping pieces of tubing with insulators inside of that gamma match rod, it is a series capacitor. By changing the amount of telescoping of that rod, you can tune that capacitor. By changing the location where the clip of the end of the gamma match rod touches the dipole, you can adjust the resistive component. So moving the clip adjust the resistive component. Changing the amount of telescoping changes the reactive component. You can make it a little bit more inductive, a little bit more capacitive by tuning above or below the amount of capacitance that cancels the inductance of the length of that rod. Let me drop. What most people don't know about a gamma match rod is that the dipole itself, if the impedance of the dipole was slightly inductive, slightly capacitive, if you made the dipole slightly shorter, the dipole would have a capacitive reactance, in which case you wouldn't need the capacitor in series with the gamma match rod. The gamma match rod could be one solid piece of tubing going out to that clip that grabs on the dipole, and you adjust the length of the dipole as a way of getting the reactance that you're looking for. If you go to the article that's in each of those two websites that supports the TechNet, one of them is www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and the other one is limarktechnet.com. You go to either of those supporting websites, and you look for the perfect impedance match of a dipole. You'll see an article by K2RIW that makes this all clear to you. Let me drop it. The world's best kept secret is that in order for a dipole to work correctly, whether it's a dipole in free space or whether it's a dipole that's a driven element for your Yagi, the dipole only has to do two things. Radiate in a dipole-like manner. It's hard for you to stop it from doing that. And to give you a good impedance match to your particular transmission line. That's all it's got to do. The exact physical length of the dipole, whether you make it an inch or two too short or too long, intentionally, in order to correct for the resistive component or the reactive component in the impedance, those are very minor perturbations that are not going to stop it from radiating the dipole-like manner. Those are just impedance matching methods. You read that article, you'll find out that by adjusting the length of the dipole, by doing nothing but adjusting the length, and you're feeding it in the center, just to be simple, you can make the resistive component of the impedance of your dipole as low as 1 ohm, by making it quite short, or by making it quite long, where it's approaching a half wavelength of each side, full wavelength total, you can make its impedance go to many thousands of ohms. So you can go anywhere from 1 ohm to many thousands of ohms, inclusive on the resistive component by doing nothing but adjusting the length of the dipole. Let me drop. So there are people who think they need all kinds of multiple rods and various changes in diameter of the dipole versus the T-match feeding. People use all kinds of crazy mechanical structures to try to get the right impedance match of their dipole inside of a Yagi, for instance. They didn't have to do that. You can make the resistive component anything you want, as low as 1 ohm and as high as many thousands of ohms, by only adjusting the length of the dipole. That's the good news. One piece of bad news is that once you choose the right length that gives you the right resistive component you desire, almost always there's a reactive component left over. If you made it longer than the usual length, it's going to be an inductor. If you made it shorter than the usual length, it's going to be a capacitor. And, therefore, by choosing the right length to give you the right resistive component, and then canceling the reactance that's left over by some other means. In the case of a dipole that wants to be 20 ohms, because it's a dipole in the middle of a Yagi. Let me drop. And you're feeding it in the center, for instance, with a ballon of some kind. And so you raise the 20 ohms up to 50 ohms by making the dipole longer. You will get exactly 50 ohms resistive. But because you made it longer than the usual length, it will be an inductor at the same time. It's going to have some inductive reactance. You simply put the right size capacitor, at first it's going to be a variable capacitor, right across the two dry points of the dipole, right at the center of the dipole, right where the gap is. You put a capacitor there, and you can cancel the inductive reactance because it's longer. You're going to get a little interreaction when you do that. As you add the capacitor, because you're doing it in shunt, you could do it in series in one step, but mechanically it's more difficult to add a series capacitor. to put a shunt capacitor across the feed points is very easy. And you get a little bit of readjustment of the resistive component, which means you adjust the length again. You can adjust the electrical length of a dipole. Let me drop it. By using what I call a tuning tool. You've got a thin wooden rod with a piece of copper tape or aluminum tape on the end of it, a small little patch. As you hold that piece of copper tape near the tip of the dipole while the thing is being fed, you're adding capacitance to the tip of the dipole. Electrically, you're making it longer. You're looking at your visual meter or your antenna analyzer or whatever when you're doing it, and as you add capacitance, the impedance either gets better or worse. You know which direction to go. If it gets better as you add, as you come up closer with your tuning tool, you know that electrically the dipole wants to be longer. So physically you do something to make it longer. Add some telescoping tubing, so to speak, out of the tip of the dipole. Or literally put chunks of copper tape out of the tips of the dipole on the left side and the right side. So electrical length is what you're talking about here. The physical length sometimes doesn't matter. So by the tuning tool, it's like a blind man walking up the hill. You know exactly which way you want to go, longer or shorter, in order to make the impedance right. And your capacitor at the center, let me drop. A poor man's capacitor at the center would literally be a piece of copper tape that goes across the two feed points, where one of the feed points has some copper tape insulating it. So you got a piece of copper tape across the feed points with underneath that some paper tape acting as an insulator on one of the feed points. With your second wooden stick, you're now taking the second piece of copper tape in the center and you're folding it back up or down, making the capacitor larger and shorter, smaller. You'll eventually come up with a perfect impedance match with these gimmick capacitors, some of them on the tip of the dipole and some of them near the center of the dipole. All you're trying to do in this case is to prove to yourself you can get a perfect impedance match. After you realize you can do that, now you take the gimmick capacitor and substitute it with a real capacitor that's weatherproofed and properly soldered down and whatever. So by adjusting length and adjusting the value of the capacitor in the center, you can make a perfect impedance match on any dipole. You don't have to use a gamma match. If you do use a gamma match, it works very well. It's a popular technique. But now you know a little bit about what's going on with a gamma match. You probably have some more questions on this one, Steve, and it's a good question. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I definitely understand a little more, the mechanism of why it's there. Now, it's interesting, in the instructions they give you a specific dimension with which to mount everything, yet they don't make a reference to using it as an adjustment for the dipole. I mean, at that point, what you're saying, if I'm understanding it correctly, I should go take my antenna analyzer now and see, where the antenna is exactly resonant and maybe go up and not follow the instruction manual, but adjust the gamma match, based upon what the antenna analyzer says. Am I right? KD2HC, back to net.
You're absolutely right, Steve. The manufacturer of your antenna told you the ballpark figures as to how to set the amount of telescoping tubing capacitance and where to adjust the clip. But they've given you the dimensions, which is the center of the ballpark. And now, if you go and measure the standing wave ratio of that antenna, and it's a 1.2 to 1, which is extremely good, and you're an exacting person, you want it to be 1.1, you can go and adjust it. But if it's a 1.2, I'd leave it alone. But if you want the impedance match to your dipole to be perfect, and if you've got enough faith in your instrumentation that you're really measuring the real thing and there's not an error in your instrumentation, then yes, by adjusting those two parameters, how far out there is the clip on the end and how much telescoping is changing the capacitance, you juggle those two things. One of them is adjusting the resistive component, one's adjusting the reactive component. When you hit the exact sweet spot, you'll get a 1.0 to 1 standing wave ratio on that antenna, if that's what you want. And even if you didn't have the gamma match rod, but this other tuning procedure I just told you about, let me drop it. By by adjusting the length of the dipole electronically by putting pieces of tape on the end, and then with your wooden stick bending them a little bit on the ends of the dipole, and another piece of tape near the center when you're changing the capacitance. There's various ways along those lines. In fact, this article by K2LIW, various people have read that and said, how come this beautiful information has been kept secret from me all these years? How to get perfect impedance match on any dipole. You can decide either of those procedures to be used, and you can make the impedance of any dipole in any location, part of a Yagi, part of a helical antenna, part of anything. You can make the impedance match perfect by these procedures if you desire to do so. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
M3XLX.
All right, well, I definitely appreciate the information, Dick. I'm going to, I'll break out the antenna analyzer, and I'll see what the stock settings, you know, what they come up with. You know, being in the middle of winter, if I'm getting a 1.2 or a 1.3, there's a good chance I'm not going up on the roof to mess with it. Like I said, my initial testing shows that this antenna is working very well. This is the first time I've actually been able to get into TechNet on the AV5 machine in almost a year. So thus far it seems to be working for me. But just for giggles, I think I'll break out the analyzer and see what the stock settings are doing for me. KD2HUC, back to net.
N3XLX.
Very fine, Steve. And come back and let us know how that turns out. November 3, X-ray, Lima X-ray, is what it sounds like. And if that's your call that is correctly, I think your name is Hayes. And go ahead, Hayes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, man. I'm just trying to test and make sure that this rig is even working. And so you gave me my first $1 if that someone can't hear me. So I just don't know what type of copy you have. And I don't even, it sounds that I've stumbled upon a net. We're here in the Bronx, first fix station. So thank you very much.
It's working very well, Hayes. You're in good shape. Okay, the next person on our list for this technical net was Joe, W2RYY. And how are those electrons treating you tonight, Joe? You've got it, Joe. K2RYW, wait for the beep. WA2, Romeo, Yankee, Yankee. K2RYW, are you there, Joe? Maybe Joe got called away. And so if Joe comes back a little bit later, we're about to go over to the space report right now. If Joe comes back a little bit later, we'll let him break in at any time that he comes back, because he was on our list. And one last listen here. Did anybody want to sign in and didn't get a chance to on the question and answer section of the TechNet? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RYW listening.
K2FIU.
It sounded like November 2 FIU. Is that true? And tell me your name, sir, and go right ahead with your question.
Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot, India, Uniform. This is George in Central Queens, Dick. Thank you.
Yeah, very fine, George. What happened is that you squeezed the mic a little bit late. You started talking, and we heard the 2 FIU and the Kilo Delta 2 got wiped out. Go right ahead with your question, George.
Dick, I'm working on building in W8JK, and in the order with a 300 ohm on 10 meters. And I want to build two of them, actually, to give me bi-directional each north-south and then east-west. And I'm finding out that the recommendations, even from Krauss, are a little vague on the length of the phasing lines between the elements and the feed line. Meaning that the elements are, of course, dipoles, two different dipoles. One is out phase.